Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta, amateur radio call sign N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading World Radio Magazine, the February 2007 issue, in digest form. Well, radio is published by Armand Noble. Armand's call is N6WR. The editor is Nancy Kott, K-O-T-T-W-Z-8-C. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any of these may violate copyright laws. Handy Hemps may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyhem@courage.org. Our website is www.handyhem.org. Let's begin today in the Editor's Log by Nancy Kott. Mars, that's M-A-R-S, is missing from the column rotation this month. Unfortunately for us, columnist Bill Sexton has decided to devote his time to other endeavors. He says, "My five-year hitch handling public relations for Mars has been challenging, enjoyable, and maybe even useful. One thing amateur radio surely learned from 9/11... all the readiness in the world does not count for much if the emergency services don't understand that we're there to help. Even with its military connection, Mars has had its share of difficulty meshing the resources of hams with the needs of government in emergency situations. We are not there yet. Call it public relations or call it education. The job is a never-ending one, and I'm thankful that World Radio has always recognized this." World Radio would like to continue to support Mars, but we need your help. If you are a Mars volunteer or have had experiences with military radio that you would like to share, please drop us a line or send us your stories to the address at the bottom of this editor's log. This issue marks my fourth year as editor of World Radio. Over these 4 years, we have experienced many changes in our amateur service and are facing new challenges. I don't think I'm being overly dramatic by saying that our behavior now may determine the future of amateur radio. Already there are rumblings by a vociferous minority that what is left of the written technical exam is too much of a burden, and it is as irrelevant as a code test, since home brewing is no longer the norm. Most of us are appliance operators. Some people think that it's discriminatory to not allow all licensees access to all the ham bands. Ham radio was never intended to be a hobby for everyone. It was created in part for the advancement of technology and experimentation. It appears to be evolving into a family radio service, and although this has brought in people who are making contributions, it opened the Pandora's box of catering to instant gratification and feelings of entitlement. Is this really what we want? Regardless of how you feel about the code test, there is no going back. We have to move forward. So let's try to get along and work together to keep what is left. A good way to start: if you're going to call CQ, listen first, and don't intentionally QRM anyone. If you don't know the code, at least learn what a question mark sounds like, so when someone sends QRL in Morse code, you realize they are asking if the frequency is in use. Invest in a good filter and learn how to use it. Use common sense. We are all in this together. Happy Valentine's Day. Send someone you care about a Valentine's greeting via the traffic net. 73-88-33. Nancy Kott. If you're interested in corresponding with Nancy, her email directly to her is nancy@tir.com. Or you can go via editor, E-D-I-T-O-R, at WR6WR.com, and even post a mail direct to her at Nancy, call W-Z-8-C, P.O. Box 807, Hadley, H-A-D-L-E-Y, Michigan, M-I, 48440. Let's begin with two or three little news pieces out of World Radio Newsfront. VK3RTS, 95th birthday Beacon. To celebrate its 95th birthday, Amateur Radio Victoria in Australia is now running a low-power beacon on 30-meter band and welcome signal reports. The Amateur Wireless Society of Victoria was founded 30 November 1911 by a meeting of wireless telegraphy experimenters in Melbourne. The society changed its name in May 1913 to the Wireless Institute of Victoria, and today is the statewide organization known as Amateur Radio Victoria. The 5-watt CW beacon with special call sign Victor Kilo 3, Romeo Tango Sierra, forward slant 95, will operate for 12 months. Reception reports go to VK3WI, Victor Kilo 3 Whiskey India, via the Bureau or by email to the numerals 95@amateurradio.com.au. Here's an American Radio Relay League announcement. ARRL's home station, W1AW, Whiskey 1 Alpha Whiskey, to shift to new digital transmission frequency. The ARRL is QSYing W1AW to a new digital transmission frequency on 80 meters as a result of the recent FCC restructuring that expanded the 75-meter phone band down to 3.6 megahertz. W1AW shifted its 80-meter digital bulletin frequency down to 3.597.5 megahertz, 15 December 06. The new frequency will be in use with the regularly scheduled 2300 UTC Universal Time Constant Digital Bulletin. The League is considering a possible change in the 80-meter CW frequency as well. And that was from the ARRL letter, compliments of AR Newsline. Next, World Radio News Front piece. Hamvention 2007 awards period now open. The Dayton Hamvention is accepting nominations for its 2007 awards for Amateur of the Year, Special Achievement, and Technical Excellence awards. The Dayton Hamvention's Amateur of the Year award goes to an individual who has made a long-term outstanding commitment to the advancement of amateur radio. The Technical Excellence Award is for the person who has made a notable technical contribution to the hobby. The Special Achievement Award honors someone who has spearheaded a project that has benefited ham radio or has benefited from it. It is important to include documentation when nominating an individual. The information is used by the awards committee to judge a candidate's overall accomplishments. Examples include magazine articles, newsletters, newspaper clippings, and video presentations. Please be aware that all material becomes the property of the Dayton Hamvention and will not be returned. The deadline for nominations is 19 February 07, and all amateur radio operators worldwide are eligible. The winners will be recognized at the 2007 Hamvention between 18 and 20 May 07. Nominations are accepted by postal mail or email. Postal mail goes to Dayton Hamvention Awards, P.O. Box 964, Dayton, Ohio, OH, zip code 45401. Additional details on the awards and nomination forms are also available at a rather long website, but I'll give it to you anyway, www.hamvention.org/nomination07.htm. That was thanks to AR Newsline. Here's another interesting piece. Find that grid online. If you are looking for a particular grid square, then Laurent Haas, H-A-A-S, call sign F6FVY, Foxtrot 6, Foxtrot Victor Yankee, may have exactly what you need. Haas has programmed the tool based on Google Earth so that you can click on any spot in the world and the corresponding full grid location is automatically displayed. Well, isn't that something? Go to F6FVY's website to use the free service. Adjust the map to the desired location and click on the spot you want to know the data on. A small window will pop up with longitude, latitude, and grid square locator. The website, it's a long one, folks, but this is sort of a cute thing, so if you're interested in it, I'm going to give it to you. It's http://fvy.free.fr/gth/locator/full-screen.html. And that came from VHF Reflector. ICOM Expedition Video, part of the RSGB 2007 yearbook. The RSGB produced a de-expedition video to be included in its 2007 yearbook. The documentary was filmed during an Islands on the Air operation from St. George Island, Florida, on September 5, with members of the ICOM family joining friends from the Tennessee Valley DX Association. Ray Novak, call N9JA, an ICOM staffer who went on the operation, says that while this de-expedition did not rival that of Peter 1, the crew had a great time, and he hopes they can share the excitement that they had doing it. The show's title is, quoting, "The Expedition for the Rest of Us," close quote, and should be available on the ICOM America website shortly. A Windows Media Player is required to view it. The website is www.icomamerica.com/amateur/video. Thank you, Newsline. Now, folks, since you're listening to this recording on the Courage Handyhem system, I'm going to give Pat Tice, the director of the Courage Handyhem system for quite a while, the privilege of being first up with the pieces today. His piece is Code by Touch, Patrick Tice, call sign WA0TDA, Whiskey Alpha Zero Tango Delta Alpha. For many operators, learning the Morse code and then making contacts with it on the air proved to be the thing they most enjoyed about amateur radio. Veterans returned from World War II, many with knowledge of the code that they had learned in the service of their country, and it was natural that they would continue to use it on the air as amateur radio operators. Young people in the post-war era were as interested in the technology of the day as young people are now, and were enthusiastic about amateur radio communications worldwide. For many of them, phone operation was simply not in the budget, but Morse code equipment could be built fairly easily and launched many a newcomer into the realm of electronics, technology, and worldwide communications. Over the years, Morse code continued to have an extraordinary following in the amateur radio community and remains to this day a very efficient way of working DX on the HF bands. Imagine the disappointment of a longtime Morse code operator who was losing the sense of hearing. It is a matter of demographics. Those early post-war operators are elderly now, and many suffer profound hearing loss. But it is a noisy world, and they are beginning to get plenty of company among middle-aged and even younger people who are suffering hearing loss. What can be done? It seems a shame for an amateur radio operator who really enjoys Morse operation and who has made many friends who use code over the years to simply give up and sell the station equipment. Sure, there are other modes to explore, including digital modes that do not require any hearing at all. The problem is that this may not be the kind of radio that you enjoy. But take heart. Even if you cannot hear well using technology like cochlear implants or hearing aids, there is a proven simple technology that may keep you on the air. Many years ago, the Courage Handyhem system had a member with a difficult problem. She was blind and deaf, but really wanted to be an amateur radio operator. She could study Braille materials to learn the theory and rules and regulations, but how would she copy the Morse code? Remember, in those days, the beginning license was the novice class, and there were no ifs, ands, or buts. She would have to pass a five-word-per-minute Morse code exam. The answer was to make the code accessible to her by touch. A speaker mounted in a wooden cabinet so that the speaker cone faced up would allow her to feel the vibrations of the code as it was being received. She would put her fingertips on the speaker cone, which was mechanically augmented by a piece of somewhat more durable plastic to protect the paper cone. A circuit would provide vibrations at a lower pitch, allowing the user to develop more accuracy and speed. This device was called a tactile pad. Amazingly, users of tactile pads can copy Morse code accurately and fairly fast. Usually, when hearing the code becomes an issue, people try to suggest visual alternatives, such as flashing lights. While Morse code can be copied by sight, every Morse code instructor I have ever known has said that the code is meant to be heard, not seen. One of the difficulties with using flashing lights has always been that the tungsten element in the light bulb has a latency as it warms and cools. Thus, the light does not switch on and off as rapidly and crisply as one might like for copying Morse code. Of course, these days, an LED can do the job with no noticeable latency, but I contend that there is still a major problem with copying by sight, and that is the persistence of vision that is built right into our eyes and central nervous systems. It is like latency in the tungsten light bulb. Our eyes and brains really don't respond quickly enough to the flashing light as it changes state from off to on and back again over and over and over. Morse code by touch does not have this problem. In addition, while our eyesight and hearing may fade as we age, our sense of touch remains accurate enough to copy Morse code with a tactile pad. In a sense, to make a pun, touch is closer to hearing than light is. As I said, the tactile pad technology is many years old. Frankly, it could use updating, and that is where you, our loyal World Radio readers, come in. Is there a better way to build a tactile pad than by mounting a speaker in a box and modifying the speaker cone? What about the electronics? That part of the tactile pad needs updating, too. Tony Tretter, called W0KVO, designed the electronic circuit that you can see in an old schematic and text about the HandyHam tactile pad. You can see it on the HandyHam website in PDF format at the following website address, http://www.handyham.org/manuals/def/tactile.pdf. So, can you build a better mousetrap or tactile pad? If you can, let me know. We will publish your design here and on the handyham.org website so that amateur radio operators suffering from profound hearing loss can take advantage of this technology and continue to enjoy talking with their friends, working DX, and even contest operation through their fingertips. The Courage Handyham system has been helping people with disabilities to enjoy amateur radio for 40 years. If you would like more information, please contact Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, MN 55422, or you can call toll-free 1-866-426-3442. Now for TTY, area code 763-520-0245, or hamradio@courage.org or www.handyham.org. Thanks a lot, Pat. Very interesting article. Our next featured piece today is by Jerry Boyd, B-O-Y-D, call sign N7WR, November 7 World Radio. It's titled, Is It Time to Reassess Where Are We Needed Most? An interesting phenomenon has occurred within amateur radio, MCOM over the past quarter century. Prior to the early 1980s, with some relatively few and notable exceptions, the focus of amateur radio efforts in time of emergency and disaster was the public. When an emergency occurred, our forte was getting health and welfare messages through when there was no other medium available for that purpose. Our claim to fame was the value of the public placed on us to let Mom and Dad in Omaha know that Susie in Anchorage survived the earthquake and was alive and well. With few exceptions prior to the early 80s, it was the public, not government, and certainly not public safety, that was the recipient of our fine work. There were several reasons for that. Until the early 80s, public safety was generally a closed society, law enforcement in particular, but to some degree fire and EMS as well, had a we can do it and we don't need any help attitude. Public safety personnel were somewhat suspicious of volunteers and did not seek ways to put them to use. Amateurs, as we are volunteers, often found the door closed, locked, and unattended when they went knocking to offer services to public safety entities. That all changed for a variety of reasons, and I, as the chief of police at the time, had the opportunity to be right in the middle of those changes. In the 1970s, there were a number of government-funded studies of law enforcement which sought to improve the profession. Those studies were an outgrowth of the riots of the mid-1960s and to some degree blamed law enforcement for those acts of public disobedience on the premise that the police were disconnected from the citizens they served. As a solution, those studies recommended, in fact, created standards requiring the inclusion of community volunteers within the public safety professions. Not just reserve police officers or volunteer firefighters, but volunteers in crime prevention, communication, senior services, investigations, and so forth. That was the opening of the door which led to the current use of volunteers of all types, including ham radio operators, by public safety entities across the nation. I was proud to have had a role in expanding the use by public safety of amateur radio operators for communication support. I authored a series of often quoted articles in ARRL publications regarding ways in which amateurs could achieve acceptance by those of us in public service. I spoke on the subject at amateur radio conventions throughout the western United States, and in concert with the police department I headed and the American Radio Relay League, produced a much-watched videotape on the subject. It was titled At Any Moment. Over time, more and more public safety entities accepted amateur radio operators and began to utilize their services in emergencies and for large-scale special events. A good thing, if that is where it had stopped. But it didn't. Over time, my fellow police chiefs, along with fire chiefs and others in government, began to see amateurs as a cost-effective way of getting routine, non-emergency work done without having to pay for it. After all, amateurs can't be paid as amateurs, can they? And if agencies expand the role of amateur radio from actual communications in an emergency to include such things as installing public safety radio equipment, operating mobile communications units, and even serving as extra eyes and ears of the department on Halloween patrol, all without cost to the agency, then that, too, is perceived as a good thing. For those amateurs not attracted solely by the opportunity to work alongside cops and firefighters, many public safety agencies threw in a few incentives. Special police, slant fire, identification cards, maybe a badge or a uniform. Some agencies with which I am familiar have gone so far as to make the leaders of affiliated amateur radio groups reserve officers with concealed firearms privileges as part of the deal. I must tell you, in all candor, that when I played a role in opening the doors of public safety to hams, oh, those many years ago, I did not envision the degree to which the welcome mat would eventually be extended. My objective back then was to ensure that when public safety communications in an emergency were inadequate to the task at hand, amateurs could and would come in to supplement, not substitute for, public safety resources. I did not envision, nor would I have supported, a situation in which amateurs substitute for what should properly be a routine function of government. I most certainly did not envision and would not have supported the all-too-common situation today where the status and prestige of the uniform, badge, or agency affiliation is what drives amateurs to become involved rather than their motivation being the idea of service and the fact that such service is one of the basic purposes of amateur radio. So, by way of historical review, amateurs in many cases became the property of the agency which issued the badge, ID, and uniform. To some extent, and I have witnessed this firsthand, too many became prima donnas. They will work for XXX County Sheriff, whether or not their service is really needed or has anything more than ego value, but they will not work for Susie in Anchorage, who today, like 25 years ago, has no way to let Mom and Dad in Omaha know she survived the earthquake, which took out both landline and cellular telephones and the Internet. Jim Wades, in his World Radio column last fall, hit the nail on the head. We have arrived at the point where government agencies too often dictate what we as amateurs will do and how we will do it. We have, as MCOM operators, lost touch with our roots, with the very basis and purpose of our existence. We fathom ourselves as emergency managers, as first responders, as public safety professionals, though unpaid, and we have siphoned off too many to serve too few. There certainly are exceptions to this picture I paint, and I am thankful for those amateurs who still serve citizens in need. The events of 9/11/01, Katrina, and Rita collectively have reduced, not eliminated, but significantly reduced, the real need government has for our communication services. Yes, there will be times when public safety communication systems fail, and our services will be needed. However, now, being directly involved in public safety communications as my livelihood, I can tell you that the billions of Homeland Security dollars spent by and on public safety over the past 5 years have reduced substantially public safety's need for amateur radio MCOM. My dispatch center serves 27 different public safety entities. We have enough technology with redundancy that I seriously doubt amateur radio will ever be needed to support their operations. I shudder when I hear people and organizations of amateurs talk about amateur radio having a significant role in public safety communications interoperability. If that's true, it is a terrible indictment of how Homeland Security grant money has been spent. Interoperability, black boxes, are commonplace, as are whole new radio systems all across the country. The pity is that while the need for amateur support of government has diminished, the number of gadgets and toys which keep so many hams glued to their police or fire department have grown exponentially thanks to those grants. I strongly believe, though I helped create this monster, that it is time to rethink our priorities and refocus our efforts in the direction of those who really need us when the big one hits. Preparing to set up stations in public places, to accurately handle message traffic for the general public who will be without any other form of communications, may not be as glamorous as staffing an EOC radio or driving the sheriff's comm van code 3. In terms of value and service, however, health and welfare traffic on behalf of citizens is critically important. That's where many of us started in MCOM, and in this writer's opinion, it is where we ought to return. The author welcomes feedback, comments, questions, and suggestions. He may be contacted via either one of the following two email addresses. First one is his call sign, lowercase, n7wr@wrrl.org, or exlasd@msn.com. Continuing with World Radio, February 2007, a piece by Mitch Gill, G-I-L-L, call YI9TU, slant, K7TUT. It's titled, Piling On, I Can Handle It, I Think. Commentary first. Sergeant Mitch Gill serves with the Washington National Guard and volunteered to serve in Iraq. He was stationed with the 505 Combat Engineers in Tikrit, and when they left in September, he volunteered to serve in Talil with the Iceland 34th Brigade Combat Team. He is scheduled to return to the States in the spring of 2007. The article goes as follows. I am a DX rookie. I have no experience working pileups. I am not ambidextrous. The TV blacks out whenever I am on the air, which does not meet the approval of my roommate. And I have an almost inverted V. I say almost, as it kind of turns a little at one end and lays across the steel roof of our hutch. The rig I'm using is an IC-706 with an antenna tuner from LDG. As you can see from the photo, which is supplied with this article, the computer is 6 inches below on my right side, and I am a left-handed keyer and type left-handed as well. The keyer is sitting on top of a plastic container that is warped, so sometimes when I am keying, I start the series of dits, but it is not intentional. The small stool hurts my back that I injured in May during a rocket attack in Tikrit, and I have no desks, so I have to turn sideways to operate. Oh, please, don't feel sorry for the back problem. It's not like I was dodging rockets. I had my full armor on, which we call our IPA, and tripped on a large rock and twisted it. It is still considered to be a line-of-duty injury, but I just call it my dumb luck. My weapon is next to me at all times, and if a rocket attack occurs, I have to grab my weapon, leave everything there, and get into a cement bunker located outside. I can only be on the air usually an hour or two at night and a half hour in the morning, except on Sundays when I get 3 hours off. I work 7 days a week, normally 9 to 12 hours a day. All that being said, I am having a blast. My favorite fun is to show up on the QRP CW frequencies and work some of the weakest stations I can find. It took 10 minutes to get one station's call from Poland, and I know that I gave him a thrill that will keep him trying to catch those elusive, more rare DX stations for a long time to come. I have had to learn to type with my right hand alone, and I take aspirin when my back starts kicking up. I can't help being on the air every minute I can. The other picture that looks like a pyramid is my other shack that I operate out of on occasion. It is a former chemical bunker that the Iraqi army used in the event of chemical attack. It has a small room that only holds about 10 people comfortably. Our troops used it for a morale welfare computer room a few years ago, so there is electricity and lights. The top of the pyramid should give me some height and keep me away from the steel roofs of the hutches. I am also located next to the ziggurat of UR, the oldest man-made structure. If I am lucky, I will operate QRP from there for about an hour. I will try to announce that before it happens. Operating in a war zone is unique. I can be operating one moment and QRT the next as I head for cover in one of the many bunkers around the area. Rockets are the biggest problem when we are not on the road, and they come in at odd times. Lately, it has been quiet here, and that allows us all to have a good night's sleep and keeps me fresh when the pandemonium of the pileup occurs. My keying is horrible, as nervous fingers are trying to key with one hand and type with the other. Let's face it, I'm a klutz. As of today, I operate mostly on 20 and 40 meters CW, as those have been open at the time on the air. Stateside comes in every once in a while. I have the ability to operate from 10 through 40 meters. My hours are usually 1500 through 1800 Zulu and 0300 through 0400 Zulu, depending on how many hours I work. On Sundays, I am on from 0400 to 0730 Zulu, so that every day I have 3 hours off in the morning. Usually, we sleep in, but I can't anymore as I want to get on the air and make some contacts. It's addicting. I wish I could thank everyone who has provided equipment and support over here, but allow me to mention a few. N200, that's November 2, Oscar, who graciously accepted my request as QSL manager. N3EQF, that's November 3, Echo Quebec Foxtrot, who provided WIN-EQF, which allows me to easily log all contacts. The South Jersey DX Association, Western Washington DX Association, and the Mike and Key Amateur Radio Club, of which I am a member. KI4BBL, that's Kilo India 4 Bravo Bravo Lima, provided a much-needed power supply. N7LSL, November 7, Lima Sierra Lima, provided a soldering gun, magazines, and arranged for cables to be sent, and many more who have provided advice and moral support. Yes, it is true that operating in a war zone is unique, but I have found it to be most interesting and worthwhile experience. I look forward to contacting as many of you as I can, but please be kind to a poor rookie with a sloppy fist. If I told you that I was keying with my left foot, would you be merciful? I don't think so. Folks, I'll repeat the gentleman's name. It's Mitchell, Mitch Gill, G-I-L-L. His Iraq call sign, I'll give it to you phonetically. Yankee India 9 Tango Uniform, Y-I-9-T-U, slant, K-7-T-U-T, slant, Kilo 7, Tango Uniform Tango. You know, there is no address here, no email from the author. I'm a little surprised, but also a little disappointed, because I would very honestly have sent Mitch a transmission to an email address via usendit.com so that he and his buddies, if they choose to, could listen to all of this right on his computer, just to let him know that we appreciate his efforts and all the efforts of our armed forces in Iraq and other parts of the world where things are not quite as easy to deal with day by day as they are here in this country. And as I think about that, folks, this is Bob, your reader, N1BLF. If any of you who are listening to this yourselves know what his email is or how he can be mailed this material, I'd like to know it so that I could continue to send him copies of these broadcasts via the internet connection. And having said that, again, my email is N1BLF. That's November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. At Comcast, comcast.net, N1BLF at comcast.net. If you want to send me something directly, believe me, I can go back into my file here on the computer, bring it up, and shoot it out there. He'll have it in about 8 minutes. The marvels of electronics, isn't it, huh? Let's see what there is on the awards page right now. The Virginia Quadricentennial Commemorative Amateur Radio Award. Boy, that's quite a mouthful. The QCWA, that's Quarter Century Wireless Association, Vic Clark Chapter 91, Washington, D.C. area, is celebrating the 400th anniversary of Jamestown Colony's founding by offering the Virginia Quadricentennial Commemorative Amateur Radio Award. In 1607, the first permanent English settlement in the New World was founded on the banks of a river, on a spit of land 40 miles upstream from where the river empties into the Atlantic Ocean. Its founders, some 100 in number, sailed from England on three vessels, the Susan Constant, the Godspeed, and the Discovery. They landed first at Cape Henry, near what is now known as Virginia Beach. Seeking a more secure location, they ventured upstream into what is now known as the James River, and they named their new settlement Jamestown. Both were named in honor of their king, James I. The Commonwealth of Virginia will be celebrating the 400th anniversary of the founding during the year of 2007. The Vic Clark Chapter 91 of QCWA is joining in that celebration by offering an award to all licensed radio amateurs for completing 25 two-way contacts with stations located in Virginia that are made on the amateur radio bands during the year 2007. This award, a colorful 8.5-inch by 11-inch certificate, will be available to all amateurs satisfying the following requirements. 1. The award will be issued for two-way contacts with 25 different stations in Virginia during the quadricentennial year of 2007. 2. Contacts must be made between 0000 UTC 01 January 2007 and 2400 UTC 31 December 2007. 3. Certificates will be serially numbered and signed by the chapter president and treasurer. 4. Contacts may be made on any frequency authorized for amateur use. Contacts through a repeater will not be credible. 5. Any mode that is legal on the frequency used will be acceptable. 6. Applicants must submit a list of contacts claimed, including call sign of each Virginia station worked, date and time in UTC, that's universal time constant, band, slant frequency, mode, QTH, or your location, and name of operator. Application must be sent by mail and not electronically. Do not submit logs via email. Do not send QSL cards. Repeat, do not send QSL cards. Each application must include a signed log certifying the list to be accurate and include your name, call sign, and return mailing address. For more specific information, use the following email for more details. It's a call sign, k6zr@arrl.net. I'll give that to you phonetically. Kilo 6 Zulu Romeo at arrl.net. That's for more details. And folks, there is also a very, very lengthy and somewhat complicated to read back to you a website address, but if you are interested in that, you know somebody who has the February 2007 issue of World Radio, it appears on page 13. Now, we're not through with the listings. Number 7, we've gone through 6 here. Number 7, the Virginia CUSO Party, 17 to 18 March 2007, is an excellent event for contacting stations in Virginia. The Virginia CUSO Party is sponsored by the Sterling Park Amateur Radio Club, SPARC, and contacts made in the Virginia CUSO Party are eligible to be used for the Virginia Quadricentennial Award. Certificates for the Virginia Quadricentennial Award and the Virginia CUSO Party must be applied for separately. 8. There is a fee of $2, $2 American, for applicants in North America to cover printing and shipping of the Quadricentennial Award. Check, cash, or money order only. No credit cards or stamps accepted. Certificates will be sent gratis to stations outside North America, but donations will be accepted. Mail your application to the address below. 9. Applications for the Quadricentennial Award will be accepted until 01 July 2008 at QCWA Vic, that's V-I-C, Clark, C-L-A-R-K, Chapter 91, P.O. Box 4112. Merrifield, Merrifield, Virginia, VA, zip code 22116-4112. Folks, those of you that are interested in the long-distance capabilities of talking back and forth with people in other countries of the world outside of the contiguous United States, it's called DX, Distant Whatever World. There's a lot of material in this month's issue put in here by Kelly Jones, called N0VD. First, he talks about a chance of a lifetime, a DX position to TI-5N, which is actually Costa Rica. And he talks about the VU-70 expedition, where a group of amateurs in India are using the call sign VU-7RG in honor of the late Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. Toward the end of the piece, there are new band allocations, information which might be very important to some of you. As you have surely heard by now, the long-awaited FCC Omnibus Amateur Radio Report and Order became law 15 December 2006. There are some notable changes that will make DXing a bit more interesting for the operators. Notably, on 75 meters, generals, that's general class licensees, will be able to use voice talking from 3,800 to 4,000 kilohertz, an increase of 50 kilohertz. Advanced class licensees will be able to use voice from 3,700 to 4,000 kilohertz, an increase of 75 kilohertz. The amateur extras will be able to use voice from 3,600 to 4,000 kilohertz, a generous increase of 150 kilohertz. It remains to be seen what this might do to the 75-meter DX window. On 40 meters, advanced and extra class licensees will be able to use voice from 7125 through 7300 kilohertz, an increase of 25 kilohertz. General class licensees will be able to use voice on 7175 through 7300 kilohertz, an increase of 50 kilohertz. And finally, on 15 meters, general class operators will have phone voice privileges on 21275 through 21450 kilohertz, an increase of 25 kilohertz. For a complete listing of what is included in the law, the docket can be found at https://gpo.gov/2006/PDF/E6-19189.PDF. Now, I know, if you copy that, just listening to me, you have a great skill that you should develop somewhere else. I'll go now to 1010 International. 2007, a perspective. The author Gerald F. Gross, G-R-O-S-S, called WA6POZ, Whiskey Alpha 6, Papa Oscar Zulu. As a newly elected president of 1010 International Net, I look forward to the opportunities and challenges I will encounter over the next 4 years. Many thanks to Chuck Imsan, W6YLJ, number 19636, for serving as the president these past 5 years. Chuck became a member of 1010 in 1978 and immediately became active, first as information manager involving himself with public relations and writing articles for World Radio. He authored the first 1010 information manual and later became the editor of 1010 News. Chuck was instrumental in establishing three 1010 operating award programs, Worked All Continents, County Hunters, and Prefixes. In 1993, Chuck joined the board of directors, and in 1995, he was elected vice president. Upon the death of President Tom Henderson, K4CIH number 33233, in 2001, Chuck assumed the presidency. In June of 2005, Chuck suffered a stroke, and since then has limited his amateur radio and 1010 activities. Chuck will continue to serve as the immediate past president. 1010 values his dedication and appreciates his continuing service. My own involvement with 1010 began in 1978, and like Chuck and I also became immediately involved. In 1980, I was elected the 1010 treasurer and remained in that position for 14 years. I became the 1010 data manager in 1993, a position I currently hold and will continue to do so for some time. One of my goals for 1010 over the next 4 years is to see active membership significantly increase. To accomplish this, 1010 must become more visible in the amateur radio community. Plans include more speakers at forums, club meetings, ham fests, and conventions. All members can help reach this goal by making 1010 part of their daily life, by checking into 1010 Nets and speaking about the organization at local club meetings. If your local organization hosts a ham fest, volunteer to lead a forum on 1010 and explain the importance of our organization. Contact me for assistance and materials. The easiest way to obtain information about 1010 is to visit the 1010 website at www.ten-ten.org. Everything you want to know about the organization is on the web, including a downloadable membership application form, a recent copy of the 1010 News, and the 1010 Information Manual are available free on the following website, www.lingerinc.com. If you do not have computer capabilities, you can receive an information package by writing to 1010 Information Package, PMB 142, 643 North 98th Street, Omaha, Nebraska, NE68114-2342. Please enclose $2 to cover the cost of shipping. If you have an issue to 1010 number and have forgotten your number, send me an email and I will find your number. A 1010 number is issued to you as an individual and for life, regardless of the call or calls you may hold. I would also appreciate any comments or suggestions. Please send them to Jerry Gross, that's G-E-R-R-Y, Gross, G-R-O-S-S, call WA6POZ, number 21274, 10-10 President, 16046 Orchard Circle, 16046 Orchard Circle, Omaha, Nebraska, N-E. 68135, or email at hiscall, WA6POZ, at ARRL.net. Now we're in the middle of winter time. Today is January the 18th, 2007, here in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right near Buzzards Bay on the Atlantic seaboard. But a lot of you are going down south or other places, whether winter weather or not, so I'm going to give you a few ham fests. If you want to go really north or central north and get good and cold, Minnesota, St. Cloud Amateur Radio Club will hold its Cabin Fever Reliever Ham Fest. That's a good title, I guess. 10 February 2007 at the St. Cloud Armory. That's at 1710 8th Street, North St. Cloud, Minnesota. On-site VE testing, 10 a.m. to noon. Talk in on 147015. There's food, fun, prizes. You can contact Fred Duke, D-U-K-E, call W0DOM, Whiskey Zero Delta Oscar Mike, at the following web address, www.w0sv.org. How about Genesee Radio Amateur, the second annual Winter Hamfest on the 17th of February at St. Anthony's Community Center, Batavia, New York. If you want to go skiing and still have a little bit of fun hamming around in Vermont, the Radio Amateurs of Northern Vermont Winter Hamfest and ARRL Vermont State Convention will be held the 24th of February, 2007 at Milton High School, Route 7 in Milton, Vermont. In Virginia, Vienna Wireless Society. Winterfest 07 will be held 25 February 2007 at the Northern Virginia Community College at Annandale, Virginia. In Michigan, Hiawatha Amateur Radio Association 28th Annual Swap and Shop to be held 3 February 2007 at the Nagumi Township Hall, Nagumi, Michigan. Those who would like to listen in and participate, if possible, with radio facilities available, special events, the 64th anniversary of the launching of the USS Kidd, K-I-D-D. It's signed Delta Delta 661. USS Kidd Amateur Radio Club will commemorate the 64th anniversary of the launching of the USS Kidd, DD 661, 28 February 2007 from 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. Operating frequencies will be inside the general class bands. Banged activity will most likely be 20 meters around 14.250 to 14.320. Other bands possible. CW activity will be near QRP calling frequencies. And one more special event. Freeze your acorns off. That's what it says, folks. Portage County Amateur Radio Service will operate station KD8CKP. Kilo Delta 8, Charlie Kilo Papa, to celebrate its second annual Freeze Your Acorns Off QRP special event. That's low power stations, usually 5 watts or less, transmit. On 24 February 2007, 1500 Universal Time Constant to 2300 UTC, general portions of 15, 20, and 40 meters. For certificates, send SASE, self-addressed stamped envelope, to Al Atkins, A-T-K-I-N-S, call KB8VJL, 12433 Chamberlain Road, Aurora, A-U-R-O-R-A, Ohio, O-H, 44202. And we have a silent key. This is an obituary. Josiah N. Knowles, Jr., call K6KEW. Joe Knowles, K6KEW, died 26 October 06 from a fall while on fire watch from the Forestry Service near Yosemite, California. Joe was 74 and lived in Marin County. Joe circled the globe via his ham radio. He participated in the emergency rescue for the Red Cross and Coast Guard when asked to do so. Joe had a special connection with Japan and once hosted 18 Japanese sailors at his home during the 1980 single-handed Transpac race from San Francisco to Kobe, Japan. He monitored, charted, and assisted with rescue operations during this open ocean race. That was furnished by the Marin Independent Journal. Ladies and gentlemen, this just about brings me up to time for the February reading of World Radio Magazine, February 2007 issue. World Radio is published by Armand Noble, call N6WR. It's located at World Radio Incorporated, 2120 28th Street, Sacramento, California, 95818. World Radio's telephone number is 916-457-3655. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Now, Handy Ham is spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. @courage.org. There is a website at www.handyham.org. My name is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo, Lima, Foxtrot. If you'd like to comment directly to me, making suggestions or recommendation as to how I should read the material for you good people, I'll give you my email. It's my call sign, N1BLF, @comcast.net, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot, @comcast.net. Thanks again for listening to me here on the Courage Handy Ham System, reading the digest form of Wealth Radio Magazine, 7388.